Early this year, President Trump gave a speech at a Boeing factory, lauding the launch of the newest model Dreamliner aircraft. He told the crowd, "This plane, as you know, was built right here in the great state of South Carolina. Our goal as a nation must be to rely less on imports and more on products made right here in the USA." But the Dreamliner wasn't just made in America. Sections of the fuselage are Italian, Korean, and Japanese. Parts of the wings are Australian, the landing gear is British, the cargo doors are Swedish, the passenger doors are French. 4 out of 5 Dreamliners will be exported, and all will be used for international travel. The Dreamliner is of the world, by the world, and for the world. Few products better epitomise globalisation. The debate over openness that's currently roiling the world turns on whether we see foreigners as likely partners or potential threats. And that question goes back to the strong bonds that characterised early human societies. Unlike most other mammals, we have this unusual aptitude for measuring emotions, building relationships, and feeling empathy. Humans have a trait called alloparenting, which means, unusually, we'll pick up another person's child if it's crying. But those same social skills mean we're very good at distinguishing who isn't part of our tribe and plotting how to defeat them. As biologist E.O. Wilson sums it up, the human condition is selfish at one time, selfless at another. Our evolutionary success came from both in-group love and out-group hate. We do see the rise of hate at times. Last weekend, for the first time since the end of World War II, neo-Nazis were elected to the German parliament. And that followed historic results for the far right in the Netherlands, Austria, Denmark, and Hungary. In France, neither of the traditional old parties made the presidential runoff. Donald Trump's win was as much a rejection of the orthodoxy of Republicans as of Democrats. Here in Australia, we had a period of just over 2 years where we went through no less than 4 prime ministers. At the end of that period, the New South Wales Ambulance Service decided that when trying to assess a patient's consciousness, they would no longer ask them the question, "Who is the Prime Minister?" There's 3 numbers that are critical to this book. 0.3%. That's Australia's share of the world population. 150, that's Dunbar's number, the traditional number of people that used to be part of the groups that we occupied for 99% of human history. And 4 out of 10, that's the share of Australians who are party loyalists. Back in the 1960s, it used to be 7 out of 10. Australia has always done best by engaging with the world. But to engage with the world is to violate Dunbar's number. It is to interact with a group of far larger than 150. Right-wing populism works by appealing to those traditions. So, 0.3% of the world, 150 is Dunbar's number, 4 out of 10 have an allegiance to a major party. We're seeing a significant rise in populism in Australia and around the world. It used to be a basic rule in Australian state elections, you never saw a swing of more than 10 percentage points. Since 2010, there's been 5 state elections with a swing bigger than that margin. Surveys as to whether Australians think their politicians are self-interested and untrustworthy, 3 out of 4 say yes, used to be half. Now I know why you're all watching me. You're worried if you turn your backs, I'll steal your wallet. This rise in right-wing populism has, in my view, 4 roots. One is lousy economic outcomes. In an age of affluence, it's easier to develop a greater appreciation for change and progress, for rationality and universal rights. But when things get tough, we tend to turn inwards. the United States, at the end of World War II, 9 out of 10 kids could expect to earn more than their parents. Now it's only half of all American kids can expect to earn more than their parents. We've seen an extraordinary phenomenon in that country of a rise in the death rate for low-educated whites, largely due to suicides, overdoses, alcohol-related liver disease. These so-called deaths of despair claim tens of thousands of American lives annually. And here in Australia, we've got sluggish wage growth, falling home ownership, and an incarceration rate that's as high as it's been since Federation. The second big driver of populism is the pace of change. We've seen huge advances in cloud computing, genetic sequencing, mobile computing, artificial intelligence. As you well know, there's a notion of Moore's Law in which computing power doubles every 2 years. We often take that for granted, so let's take Moore's Law and apply it to cars. If we'd had a generation worth of Moore's Law, then our vehicles would cost a few cents to buy, use a few litres of petrol each year, and move at 500,000 kilometres an hour. The news cycle is faster too. No wonder people feel, as Thomas Friedman puts it, that they're dancing in the eye of a cyclone. And third, right-wing populists have benefited from pretty canny political entrepreneurs, a willingness to break taboos, and a willingness to draw on a set of values not traditionally used by mainstream politicians. Notions of loyalty, authority, sanctity, the notion of disgust, which is rarely used among politicians, particularly on the progressive side. And fourth, minor parties are growing because major ones are shrinking. Barclays looked at the vote for centrist parties in 22 advanced countries and found that they'd dropped by about 12 percentage points. Across Europe, political party membership has approximately halved since the 1970s, which is a moment at which I should really say thank you to the Australian Labor Party members who have taken the time to come along tonight. This disengagement from traditional politics is of a piece with the disengagement with big business, trade unions, churches, and other traditional institutions. What all of this has led to is a notion that there are simple solutions to the world's problems, that the corrupt dunderheads in charge just need to get out of the way and all will be well. As H.L. Mencken used to put it, there's always a well-known solution to every human problem. Neat, plausible and wrong. But part of the answer in combating populism is to recognise that sharing prosperity isn't just about fairness. It's also an effective counter-radicalisation strategy. Openness does raise average living standards, but some people can invariably be hurt. Redistributing part of the gains from openness from the winners to the losers is essential if the beneficiaries want to avoid a populist backlash. Choosing openness focuses on three big areas for Australia: trade, migration, investment. And at risk of giving you the punchline, I just want to say a few words about each of those areas. To trade first. Economists see trade principally as a form of specialisation. When asked about the benefits of free trade, an economist would probably say, well, would you choose to grow your own food, to cut your own hair, homeschool your children, build your own house, and fix your own car? Well, chances are you'd prefer to specialise, to choose an occupation, become an expert in it, and use your earnings to buy other services in the market. International trade is just an extension of that idea. As I've noted, Australia's population is just 0.3% of the world, so it doesn't make much sense for us to produce everything we use. By trading, we can focus on what we do best, rather than trying to do everything. As economist Paul Samuelson once put it, comparative advantage is the best example in the social sciences of an idea that is true and not trivial. Now, unlike the FIFA World Cup, the Davis Cup, or the Eurovision Song Contest, trade isn't a zero-sum game. In those international contests, there can be only one country that wins. As Anthony put it when he was editing the book, usually Germany, in extra time. In those contests, if one nation improves, then by definition it must be at the expense of another. But trade isn't like that. Your hairdresser doesn't defeat you when you buy a haircut from them. Japan doesn't win when you buy a Honda. Sellers aren't vanquishing buyers. Both are benefiting from specialisation. And when Australia, under Whitlam and Hawke and Keating and Howard, chose to reduce tariffs, we did so because, as Joan Robinson put it, even if your trading partner dumps rocks in their harbour, it doesn't make sense for you to have rocks in yours. Those tariff cuts weren't principally a bargaining chip. They were done because we knew it would benefit the domestic economy. It's an insight which can sometimes be lost, but often quickly encapsulated. When President Trump proposed a 20% import tariff on Mexico, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham was quick to point out it would drive up the cost of Corona, tequila, and margaritas. Trade stretches the household budget further. To get a sense of how much further, I went back to some old Canberra Times newspaper ads from 30 years ago and just asked the simple question, what did a pair of kids' school shoes cost then and what does it cost now from Kmart? The answer is, back then they were $10, now they're $9. A Toyota Corolla back then was $12,000, now it's $20,000. Though, it is twice as powerful. And you can certainly find new cars for not much more than $12,000. In dollar terms, the last 30 years has seen a tripling of wages. But you could still use the same price stickers to sell shoes and cars. And because the poor spend more than the rich, the reductions in tariffs and their flow-through effect to prices is a progressive measure. If you don't like a 15% GST, you shouldn't like tariffs either. Yes, there's a job impact of trade. But as one US study has shown, 4/5 of the job loss in manufacturing is being driven by technology rather than trade. Globally, the share of the world's workforce that works in manufacturing is falling. When we're seeing that at a global level, it can't be the case that trade is the culprit. And then we come to migration. Across the globe, there's so many migrants, 250 million, that if they all lived in the same country, then that would be the fifth largest country in the world. There are 1 billion people every year who travel as international tourists. Right now, as we sit in this room, 9,000 passenger flights are aloft. According to a Gallup survey, 2/5 of the world's population in developing countries would move to the developed world if they had a chance. That reflects the fact that migrants are the biggest beneficiaries of migration. A Tongan who moves to New Zealand quadruples their earnings. An Indian who moves to the United States sextuples their earnings. Yes, that's right, I'll say it again, sextuples. And people do worry about job loss for the native-born workers. But the OECD's reviews found little evidence of it. For example, in Australia, we've had an influx of migrant physicians, such that foreign-born doctors are now a majority of the medical workforce. And it's no surprise from that that we've seen an increase in the prevalence of home visits, once thought to be an anachronism of the 19th century. To see migrants as merely crowding out local workers is to miss the fact that migration isn't just about mouths, it's also about minds. If extraordinary people like Marie Curie or Albert Einstein are one in a million, then it follows that they're also an argument for another million people. And with a larger population comes a bigger chance of making the next breakthrough. Every migrant has the chance of being the next Tan Lee, Dr. Carl, Ruslan Kogan, Hoi Trong, Victor Chang, Gus Nossel, or of course, Frank Lowy. Migrants have higher patenting rates, are more likely to author highly cited scientific research. Migrants are more likely to win Nobel Prizes. Australians' attitudes towards migrants are warmer than in many advanced countries and have become warmer over time, including for our refugee program. Migrants do sometimes get blamed for high housing prices, but it's a bit unfair given they're more likely to bunk in with friends or buy small houses. Investors want higher house prices. Migrants, like first home buyers, would prefer greater affordability. And if you want less traffic congestion, it probably makes more sense to stop blaming migrants and start thinking about how we can ensure that our cities have high functioning public transport systems and encourage the shift to driverless cars. And finally, foreign investment. Australia's foreign investment rules have their origins in a famous piece of Australian cuisine, the Chico Roll. It was the Chico Roll, a tube casing made of egg and flour and deep fried in oil, such that it allows a scantily clad woman to eat one while riding a motorbike. It was the sale of the prospect of that product being sold to an American conglomerate, IT&T, that caused the Whitlam cabinet to put in place the current foreign investment review rules. Over the years, Australians' attitude to foreign investment have, if anything, probably soured, gone in the reverse direction to migration. 90% of Australians say the federal government has a responsibility to ensure major Australian companies are kept in majority Australian control. Foreign investment, in the minds of many Australians, is about as popular as cane toads and fire ants. So why do economists disagree? Well, one answer is that foreign investment is the way we fill the gap between domestic savings and domestic investment, the so-called current account deficit. That gap last year was $44 billion, or about 1/9 of total domestic investment. So without foreign investment, we would either have to increase household saving by $4,500, which means each of your households cut their spending by $4,500, or reduce our total national investment by 1/9. That's 1/9 fewer buildings, 1/9 fewer solar plants, 1/9 fewer roads. We'd also think of foreign investment as raising the ratio of capital to labour in an economy, sort of the opposite of what migration is doing. By raising the ratio of capital to labour, we put upwards pressure on wage rates. And it means that a country that is both open to migration and open to foreign investment should be able to sustain its ratio of capital to labour, and therefore, from a worker's standpoint, to sustain its wage levels. We also need to be very careful about making sure we don't fall in the trap of thinking that because a firm is foreign-owned, all the benefits flow offshore. After Canadian company Labatt Breweries was sold to a Belgian firm, one executive of the firm said that what mattered was our beer is made with Canadian raw materials by Canadian employees who belong to Canadian unions. According to the American car website, cars.com, the most American-produced cars aren't those made by the big three. They're the Honda Accord and the Toyota Camry, manufactured in the United States by Japanese firms. Ensuring that Australia is open to foreign investment opens us to the possibility of critical new investments. Large-scale battery storage, a better linked-up national electricity grid, driverless car technologies that ensure the infrastructure is ready to support their uptake, making disused industrial land safe for medium-density housing close to our cities, a fibre-to-the-home national broadband network. Foreign investment might allow us to expand train links in places like the Gold Coast, put a new ring line in the Melbourne Metro, expand Canberra's light rail network, might allow us to put in place the M9, the Sydney Orbital Road that's been long talked about, or a rapid transit busway to Sydney's northern beaches. But we've got to tackle the challenges that that are currently bedeviling foreign investment around national security screening, the treatment of real estate and tax. Choosing Openness tells an optimistic story about our engagement with the world, but it's written at a time at which there is a real risk of disengagement. Trade is now less important to the world economy than it was before the crisis. Foreign investment as a share of global output is half what it was in 2007. Permanent migration is down from its levels in 2007. And there is a possibility that we might look back to the period before the global financial crisis, just as John Maynard Keynes looked back to 1914, at the beginning of World War I, where, as he wrote, an inhabitant of London sipping his morning tea in bed could order by telephone products made anywhere in the world, could invest in enterprises in any quarter of the globe, and could travel anywhere without a passport. An era of globalisation on which the doors slammed shut. Now, Choosing Openness contains a plethora of policy ideas, from multinational tax to education, how we handle national security issues around foreign investment, and the risk of preferential trade deals. I won't run through each of them tonight, but I do want to say one thing about how we practice politics in an era in which openness is desirable. Because one of the trends that worries me, and this might surprise you to hear from a partisan, is the increase in partisanship in politics around the world. A rising share of Australian voters say that they strongly dislike the opposing political party. In the United States, in the 1960s, hardly anyone cared about the prospect of their child marrying somebody from the opposing political party. Now, nearly half of Americans say they would be upset at the prospect of their child marrying someone from a political party. More upset than if their child told them they were gay or was to marry somebody of a different race. There's British Labour supporters wearing T-shirts saying, "Never kissed a Tory." We don't just oppose our opponents. Increasingly, we actively loathe them. The risk of this is that angry politics is precisely the hothouse conditions under which populism can thrive. In an intellectual sense, it creates that notion that the current elites are failing. But in an emotional sense, excessive hostility creates a climate of stress, which we know from the political psychologists is particularly conducive to appeals to hunker down, to reject outsiders, to turn away migrants, and to put up the tariff walls. Engaging with the yearning that many voters experience for the past is the right way to go. Fighting fire with fire is the wrong way to go. It reminds me of a lovely observation by George Orwell, the end of World War II, where he distinguished between patriotism, a love of your country, and nationalism, a belief that your country is better than every other. As Orwell says, there's nothing wrong with being devoted to a particular place and way of life. But once you start shouting about how superior your country is to others, it's easy to overlook your country's shortcomings. Now, I know all of this might sound a little bit too timid, but it is useful to remember that the problem of even-handed centrists being shouted at by bellicose extremists has a pretty long history. As Yeats put it nearly a century ago, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Personal insults and Twitter trolls, I'm afraid, are yet to bring about the downfall of a single populist extremist. We have to deal with the inequality that can accompany technological change and economic openness. As a matter of not just fairness, but to quell the backlash against openness, open markets require egalitarian institutions. So because I'm a progressive, I support openness as a means of raising overall living standards. But because I support openness, I believe in redistributive policies to ensure the gains are fairly shared. I hope Choosing Openness provokes conversations and encourages you to engage with friends and neighbours and colleagues about these questions. Thank you for being here tonight, and very much look forward to your questions.